Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up in a few moments, why Saints Peter and Paul? Scripture scholar Archbishop Mark Coleridge fills us in. Cardinal Nicholas Wiseman, not so really terribly English after all. And spotlight on a sculpture above the main altar in a church just across the Tiber from St. Peter's, San Giovanni dei Fiorentini. Well, thanks so much for joining me once again. As we look ahead to the feast of Saints Peter and Paul, which falls each year on the 29th of June, why not join our scripture scholar, Archbishop Mark Coleridge, so he can explain to us why these two apostles enjoy the same feast day instead of two separate ones. So what brought them so close together?
One of the most striking things about the city of Rome, one of the many striking things, is that it's not just that it's the city of St. Peter and Paul, as if you see Peter in some parts and Paul in other parts. In fact, wherever you go in the city, you never see Peter unless you see Paul, and you never see Paul unless you see Peter. They're always together. You walk into St. Paul's outside the walls, and there, standing up in the front of the basilica, are big statues of both Peter and Paul. Similarly, you walk into Piazza San Pietro, and again you see heroic statues of the two of them. Not only do we see them represented together like that around the city, but in the church around the world. We celebrate their feast day on one day, 29th of June. And the question is, why don't we have a day for them each? Aren't they important enough, surely, to warrant a day? And yet, here we have them celebrated together in one city on one day. Now, this becomes all the more peculiar and interesting when you recognise that in life they fought, and they fought about things that weren't just trivial but went to the very heart of what Christianity and the Church are. The first time that Paul meets Peter is in those years after his Damascus Road encounter, when he's knocked down, stripped of power, and when he hears the call to be the apostle to the non-Jewish world. After that encounter on the road to Damascus, Paul vanishes into what he calls Arabia for quite some time, and then eventually emerges from the desert to undertake a mission, his first ever mission, perhaps, in Damascus. Again, his life is under attack immediately. He's lowered down the wall in a basket, and away he goes. And then beyond that experience of mission in Damascus, he decides to go up to Jerusalem. Now, for Paul, this was a very delicate moment because he was known to be a persecutor of the church. But he felt he had to go up and meet those whom he calls pillars of the church. He met Peter, James, and John. He calls Peter Kephas, which was Peter's name in Aramaic. Same nickname, means rock. But Peter, James, and John were the big three, the Troika, in Jerusalem. So Paul, at this moment, is driven, as it were, to go up and meet them, whom he had almost certainly never met before. Now, he needs a diplomatic bridge, someone who can introduce him to a community who was still highly suspicious of the former persecutor. And the diplomatic bridge he finds is the crucial figure in his life of Barnabas, real name Joseph. Barnabas was his nickname, son of encouragement. He must have been that sort of man. So Barnabas it is who takes Paul to meet Peter. And in his letter to the Galatians, Paul says that I went up to Jerusalem to, the word he uses in Greek is historesai, to historesai Peter. Now, this verb in Greek can mean two things. It can mean to give information to or to receive information from. I think Paul uses this verb precisely to say, I wanted to hear something from Peter and I wanted Peter to hear something from me. Now, what did he want to hear from Peter? He wanted to hear about Jesus. Paul had never met Jesus. I think when you read the letters, that's clear. He never knew Jesus personally, but Peter most certainly did. So he needs to hear a lot from Peter about the historical Jesus, who he was, what he did, what he said. Peter needs to hear from Paul the real story, from the horse's mouth, as it were, of Paul's own conversion. So here they are, the two of them, for about a fortnight in Jerusalem, exchanging information, telling their stories to each other. Paul then vanishes from the scene. He goes home to Tarsus for a long time, and at this stage he could have plummeted off into the black hole of history. But in fact he doesn't, because again it's Barnabas who brings him back onto the stage as one of the leadership team of Antioch, where the gospel was first preached to non-Jews, to Gentiles. Barnabas was the one sent down from Jerusalem to discern this volcanic and potentially dangerous situation where the gospel is moving out of Judaism into the Gentile world. Barnabas needs to recruit the right kind of leaders, and he thinks Paul. So he goes to Tarsus, finds Paul, brings him back to Antioch, and there for about a year, we're told, Paul is part of the teaching team, the leadership team. Then he becomes part of the first ever Christian mission team to leave Palestine and enter the Mediterranean world. Barnabas was the leader of that first ever mission. Paul's the kind of vice captain, and John Mark is the third member of the team. They again preach the good news of Jesus to non-Jews out there in the Mediterranean world. And this creates enormous controversy in the infant church. And as a result, when they come back to Antioch, they have to go up to Jerusalem, again, to meet with the mother church in this moment of crisis and controversy. So Paul and Barnabas go up, and again Paul meets Peter in what's called the Council of Jerusalem. And it's Peter who eventually stands up and delivers a kind of compromise judgment, really, that the gospel is for the Gentiles, but the Gentiles need to respect Jewish sensibilities on certain counts. So here again, a second moment where Paul meets Peter. And Paul, like everyone else in the early church, deferred to the unique authority that Peter had received from Jesus himself. No one doubted that, certainly not Paul. The third time, and in some ways the last time that Paul meets Peter, is again in Antioch, where Peter has come down and he's sharing table fellowship with non-Jews, non-Jewish Christians. Jewish Christian and Gentile Christian sitting down at one table. Now this undermined the fundament of Jewish religious identity, which was separation of the Jewish and Gentile worlds. Now you had Peter and Paul sitting down as Jewish Christians with non-Jewish Christians, sitting at the one table to eat and to celebrate the Eucharist, therefore. Some of the James Party, as they're called, some of the conservative Jewish Christians from Jerusalem, James was the residential leader of the church in Jerusalem, come down and they say, you can't eat with them. You Jewish Christians have to separate. We have one church, two tables. And Paul says, no, wrong way, go back. You are re-erecting the barriers that God has knocked down in Jesus. Therefore, you are doing the work of Satan. At this stage, Peter and Barnabas agree with the James people who have come down from Jerusalem, and Paul looks a very isolated figure. He has to make a decision. He could have either gone home to Tarsus, just said, it's a bad joke, I'm out of here, or he could have said, well, you were right and I'm wrong, I beg your pardon, I didn't want to create all the trouble. Or, and this is what he does in fact, he could decide to set up his own mission team. So what comes to birth in this brawl at Antioch is the independent Pauline mission. And the issue that Paul and Peter fight about is really the nature of the church. Is the church a kind of sect within Judaism? Or has it been born from the womb of the synagogue as some new, distinctive initiative of God's? Paul says that Christianity is not just part of Judaism. It has been born, thrust forth, as it were, from the womb of the synagogue as something new that God is doing for all people, not just for Jews, but for Gentiles as well. At that stage, Peter and Paul part ways. Paul will reappear in Jerusalem from time to time, but we don't exactly know what went on there. He will never again return to Antioch as he sets forth on the path of his independent mission. Eventually, the stories of Peter and Paul will converge. Their paths will cross in the most decisive way, because both of them were among the Christian leaders in Rome in the mid-60s who were swept away in the tide of blood that came with the persecution of the Emperor Nero. So both suffer a martyr's death, that much is certain. Paul is beheaded on the way out to Ostia at what is now Tre Fontane. Peter is crucified in what was Caligula's circus, and that is now St. Peter's Square. Now, what happens in this moment is that in the moment of their death, and Rome is the city of their death, they didn't found the church in Rome, but they died here. In the moment of their death, they find their way so completely and so profoundly to Jesus crucified and risen that they find their way to one another. That's the key. They find a communion in Jesus crucified and risen in their death that they didn't and couldn't find in their life. So, why does the church celebrate the memory of the two of them so intensely in one city, where they're always represented together, and celebrate their memory particularly on one day, the 29th of June? Because in this, the city of their death, they become so completely, as it were, immersed in Jesus. They become Jesus crucified and risen, that they move beyond all their differences and disagreements to find their way into that perfect communion, which is in Jesus crucified and risen. And that's why the Petrine ministry, the papacy, looks not just to Peter, but also to Paul, because the Pope, as heir to the witness of both Peter and Paul, the Bishop of Rome, is the prime servant of the communion which they found in death.
Heartfelt thanks there once again to Australian scripture scholar Father Mark Coleridge, Archbishop of Canberra and Goulburn. And now I'd like to join someone who is terribly English, or isn't he after all? He's Cardinal Nicholas Wiseman. I thought of speaking of him today because of his link to St. Peter and Paul through the hymn Full in the Panting Heart of Rome. But let's join our historian, Stella Fletcher.
Yes, it's the 19th century, and this is the Irish dimension. Cardinal Wiseman was not very British, but he was in Rome. The Wisemans actually came from Waterford in southern Ireland. But Cardinal Nicholas Wiseman was born in Seville in 1802. There was, in fact, a large Irish community there. However, the family moved back to Ireland just 2 years later. In due course, Wiseman came to Rome to study for the priesthood. And he was among the first students to enter the venerable English college after the period of closure at the time of the French Revolutionary and Napoleonic Wars. He was in his 20s and rapidly gained a reputation as a scholar, as a Syriac scholar. Now, there wasn't much call for that, but he was lauded by his fellow academics and obtained rapid promotion. First as vice-rector of the English College and then as rector in 1828. So he was just 26 when he became rector of the English College. He remained in that post for 12 years. In 1835, he visited England, a country that he didn't know all that well. What he observed during that visit was that the English Catholics needed to be far more organised than they were at that point. England was mission territory for the Roman Catholics in that time. It did not have bishops. Under British law, only the Church of England could have, you know, bishops of somewhere or other. So the Catholics had to organise themselves under the leadership of vicars apostolic. Wiseman observed this organisation. He saw that the Catholic Church in England was growing dramatically, not just in terms of the famous converts from Anglicanism, but also because of the growing numbers of Irish immigrants. Wiseman came back to Rome and entered into negotiations for the establishment, or should it be re-establishment, of the Catholic hierarchy in England and Wales. Now, there was controversy over this. Some people, including an English cardinal based in Rome, Cardinal Acton, objected that the British establishment would be alienated by this move and that it wasn't a good way of establishing the Catholics in British public life. However, Wiseman got his way, and in 1850, the hierarchy in England and Wales was re-established, with Wiseman himself as top dog, the first Archbishop of Westminster. Westminster is part of London, but he couldn't be Archbishop of London because there was already an Anglican Bishop of London, so he had to be Archbishop of Westminster. There were terrific celebrations among the English or British community here in Rome. And those celebrations were organised by the daughter of the Earl of Shrewsbury, who was married to a member of the Roman nobility, the Doria Pamphili, and had a large house in which it was possible to hold large celebrations. Finally, we come to the reason for talking about Wiseman here, because we are little more than a stone's throw from the Flaminian Gate. The main gateway, Porta del Popolo, the main gateway out of Rome to the north. And Wiseman, on the 7th of October 1850, wrote a pastoral letter to the Catholics in England. It was entitled From Without the Flaminian Gate. It was triumphalist. It was not diplomatic. It was basically saying, hurrah, aren't the English Catholics doing well? It was regarded with great suspicion and hostility in Britain. Queen Victoria was outraged. She declared, am I Queen of England or am I not? Because here were these Catholics coming in, declaring that we're now going to be subject to the Pope again, something like that. Anyway, the Prime Minister, Lord John Russell, objected publicly to papal aggression. This aggression, I suppose, summarised in this letter from without the Flaminian Gate. The controversy, like most controversies, simmered down in the course of time. Wiseman did go to Westminster. He was Archbishop there from 1850 to 1865 when he died. And historians maintain that he did a jolly good job as the first Archbishop. He addressed serious problems in his archdiocese, such as Catholic education. What should be done for all these hundreds and thousands of incoming Irish people? But Wiseman was never really terribly English. He fitted in here rather better than he fitted in England.
And you were listening there to historian Stella Fletcher, a familiar voice to our regular listeners. Finally, in a few moments, you can hear another familiar voice. It's that of our Professor of Fine Arts, Breda Ennis, with whom I once went to a church right across the Tiber River from the Vatican, where there's a sculpture by Antonio Raggi right above the main altar. And we're sitting on the front bench of the church of San Giovanni ai Fiorentini, so dedicated to St. John and linked to Florence in some way. But we're actually here to look at a sculpture above the main altar, where normally, Breda, there's a big painting, whereas this is a huge sculpture, you told me, by Antonio Raggi. Why a sculpture above the main altar? It's the baptism of our Lord.
Yes. Well, probably most times they don't get it quite right in terms of the subject matter, or let's say the drama that you need in a big image over the main altar. Because the main, what they call the pala, the main altar pala, is always the most important in the church because it's right above the altar. And if you look below, the altar is designed by Pietro da Cortona. And this altar had many modifications before it became what we see now, including the hand of Borromini. And if you look up, you'll see curved effect that you get in all the works of Borromini. But going back to the sculpture, you see on the right is St. John the Baptist, who's just moving forward, putting his weight on one foot and on a rock, as you will always find John the Baptist when he's baptizing Christ. Christ is just below him in the water, and he's bent towards St. John the Baptist, who is about to pour the water on his head. Now, above, and let's say in towards the back, this is a high relief sculpture, meaning that the figures are almost three-dimensional, even though it's attached onto a background where you have clouds and angels. It's almost slightly abstract too in certain aspects. It's almost like a big plank of irregular wood put behind, but done in marble, of course, all of this, just to give a sense of power to the two figures that are below. And what people don't know about this altar is that there is a tiny little window hidden in the frame of this sculpture, which lets in natural light onto the figure of Christ and a little more light onto the figure of St. John the Baptist. And everybody thinks somebody has switched on a light here and put it on. Instead, it's illuminated from the outside. And if you look over and you see John the Baptist has the strong staff that he's carrying in his hand. And this is the first crozier. It's the first bishop's crozier, used now by bishops or popes. It originates in what John the Baptist had, with this long stick with the top part in the shape of a cross. So the iconographical element of the crozier goes back to John the Baptist. And again, you see this lovely, very expressive and spiritual feeling about the way the two figures are relating to each other. And Raggi, of course, was a student of Bernini. So you can see the influence also here of Bernini in the way of, you have flowing robes. Christ's robes are flowing out towards the light, as you can see on the left, with an angel behind him just watching, but in the shadows. And then on the right, you have John the Baptist again carrying those heavy robes that he tends to carry. They seem heavier, more, let's say, I would say temporal. The clothes that John the Baptist has are temporal in the sense that they give you. Yet the clothes that Christ has on give you a sense of something that's moving upwards and moving away and more of another world, giving the sense that this baptism of Christ signifies the recognition of the Messiah and the beginning of the temporal work of the church on earth. In a sense, the papacy goes back to its origins, goes back to this scene.
Breda, would you say that this particular sculpture has a coldness that goes with elegance, because it's incredibly elegant, this whole sculpture and the altar in itself?
Mm-hmm. Well, if you look at the pilasters on one side of the altar, which are pale, marbly, whitey, off-white, sort of dirty white, and then again you can say that the same thing about those figures behind the altar, and yet the altar itself is a mass of red marble. So you have this moving from the pale beige, white, to the red marble, and then onto John the Baptist and Christ, who are pale and marbly, and then out again to the red pillars of marble, and then again over to another area where you have white marble, and then turning beyond that to black and then white. So you have this constant little orchestra of colour. But the movement is created by the alternating aspect of the colour. You notice the altar rails also have the red marble. And the top of the altar, way, way up in the top, the one designed by Borromini. And a little side note, obviously Borromini is buried in this area here, around the main altar. He wanted to be buried near Maderno, his great master, the man who brought him to Rome, and below the dome, designed by Maderno. So, and he got his last wish.
He's buried here.
Over there on the left-hand side of the altar. And over there you have Maderno's grave, and in a way he's in front of something he designed as well, that both of them designed. They're near something that some of their creations, which is something
maybe
beautiful.
Maybe that's the elegance they're talking about. It goes back to Borromini.
Yeah.
His architectural excellence, no?
Borromini is, in my opinion, the greatest architect of the Baroque. I mean, I love Bernini, but Borromini, for me, surpasses him in the spiritual content of the work. It's very subtle, it's very elegant, it's very fluid, it moves like water. It's turbulent, like the man himself, but yet it's a controlled turbulence. All his architecture has controlled turbulence. And in a sense, these figures behind them, the altar, John the Baptist and Christ, with all the movement that they have, create a slight contrast, being more Bernini towards the Bernini. But in a way, they complement what Borromini did. So this old idea of the competition between the two, in my opinion, has no real basis, because more than anything, they were complementary. And again, if you can see the figure of Christ and John the Baptist, there's this lovely complementary sense also in the roles there and in the movement. And then it's all swirling movement, and then beautiful linear, but sort of semi-controlled linear, with a little bit of controlled, more elegant curving at the top of the altar of Borromini. So this is the artistic marriage of Borromini and Bernini, in a sense, because you're thinking of Raggi and the effect on Raggi's work of Bernini.
My thanks there go to Breda Ennis, a professor of fine arts, who's currently teaching at the American University of Rome. And while that brings us up to time, you may be wondering why I haven't spoken to you about the forthcoming Feast of Corpus Christi, simply because I'll be doing that at the same time tomorrow, when you can hear musical notes to mark Corpus Christi with Monsignor Philip Whitmore, and also a programme in which Jill Bevilacqua takes us on a pilgrimage to Bolsena. She recounts what exactly happened there and why. The story is probably familiar to some of you. A priest has doubts about the real presence of Christ in the Eucharist as he's celebrating Mass one day, and an extraordinary thing happens. And that really does bring me up to time. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks so much for listening. Should you wish to check out our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. Bye for now. You've been listening to the English programme of Vatican Radio. Laudetur Jesus Christus.